The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Potosky in Paris, and our London team. People, introduce yourselves.
I'm Keith Stewart. I'm the games editor for The Guardian.
Hey!
And Jemima, that was you. You are the...
I'm the head of technology, so I'm in charge of this whole chaotic mess of stuff that we do every day.
Alex?
And I'm Alex Hearn. I am a technology reporter and Doge correspondent.
And Bitcoin.
And Bitcoin, that's true. Well, later on, we're going to be hearing from Samuel Gibbs, who'll be reporting from Barcelona, where he's covering this year's Mobile World Congress. And we will hear from him and this young mover and shaker later in the podcast.
Although Yahoo is a big company, it's a traditional US internet company, since Marissa Meyer, the culture within has felt very much like a startup. And so I've been able to leverage that freedom.
Sumly founder Nick DeLoisio launching the new UK edition of the Yahoo News Digest app. And our Samuel got the skinny. Why did social network Facebook shell out 19 billion clams, dollars, for mobile messaging service WhatsApp? And we'll hear about the multiplayer voyeur phenomenon gripping the weird world of Pokemon. That's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Facebook stunned, well, everyone this week by purchasing a mobile messaging service for an astonishing, mind-blowing, and frankly excruciating $19 billion. And I say excruciating because as soon as the deal was announced, a Tumblr popped up with a list of the many, many things that could be purchased for that unimaginable sum of cash. A year of research at NASA, for example. The entire US budget for one day. A year of US national school lunches. The Large Hadron Collider, MMR vaccines for every baby in the world, and perhaps, most ironically, given the Facebook founder and CEO's college background, full-time Harvard education fees for more than 300,000 students. So please, Jemima, what is WhatsApp and why is it worth $19 billion?
The first thing to say about buying something for $19 billion is that something is valued according to whatever value somebody is prepared or whatever price somebody is prepared to pay for it. And Facebook has quite a lot of money. WhatsApp is a mobile messaging app. You can text any one of your friends that uses the service for free. So it's very, very simple. And also it plays to a lot of the objectives that Facebook is now trying to fulfill, namely being an essential mobile tool and mobile first. So a lot of the people that use this app might be a bit sort of disillusioned with the intensity of social media, and they're more interested in just using their mobile phone and talking directly to their immediate friends, not this sort of, you know, much grander vision of self-publishing about your life, which is a bit kind of done now.
WhatsApp has a really strongly installed user base amongst the youth, she says, as an old lady, the youth, as well as a really strong user base in Asian and African markets. So is this Facebook's attempt to grab a group of people who haven't engaged with their service or perhaps are moving away?
It's got 450 million active users, which is a huge number. Any number next to Facebook's 1.1 billion users overall, it's obviously going to a little bit less. But 18 billion messages a day. It's sort of quite easy to think that perhaps a mobile operator, given that they want to protect the amounts that they can charge their users for text messages, why didn't they buy it? But they don't have this amount of money in the bank. I think in terms of the audience that Facebook is trying to reach, it's the people, as I just said, who are a bit disillusioned with social media, who are doing much more direct and possibly more important chats straight to their friends. And they probably are younger, they're probably European, they're probably not Chinese because a service like WeChat is much bigger in China. Overall, though, the developing world is a very key area for Facebook. I couldn't find any specific statistics on Africa and Asia for WhatsApp usage, but some fantastic, fascinating statistics came out in Mark Zuckerberg's talk at Mobile World Congress this week. These are numbers put together by Deloitte. So there are 6.8 billion mobile subscriptions in the world. So that's individual SIMs. And of those, 5.2 billion are in the developing world. So that's the kind of world that Facebook is sort of mapping out the territory for, and that is the kind of market that Facebook is pushing into, which will be mostly feature phones and a lot of people using messaging. So they see this very clearly as a way to push forward into loads of new markets, and as they're saturated in their key markets, that would seem to make sense.
Additionally, there's a sort of design flaw with Facebook when it comes to the networking that has worked in its favor up until now, and that is that in order to be connected with somebody, their social graph, the behind the scenes work that they do, that they then sell on to advertisers, who's connected with whom, it has to be a reciprocated tie. So it has to be, I'm a friend of yours, Jemima, and we know this because you're a friend of mine. But their more recent purchases of, I think they now own, what, four of the largest mobile apps on the market, including things like Instagram. Those are services in which you don't have to have reciprocal relationships. You can just, you know, send a message on WhatsApp to somebody else. They don't have to be connected with you or Instagram. I could follow your Instagram feed. So is this them trying in some ways to expand their social graph to not necessarily include the entire network, which has its shortcomings, but rather like this expansive potential maw of connections that they can then exploit?
Zuckerberg's thinking is changing to acknowledge that there are different types, there are different ways that people like to engage. And a lot of the time, people like to be able to communicate in a less formal way. They don't always want to have to say, this is me and I'm making a statement to the world. It might be a more casual way of communicating. It might be one where they want to be anonymous. And he said, actually, that he recognises that sometimes, you know, people do want to be anonymous when they're communicating.
I do also think there is another motivation for Facebook making this sort of acquisition, which is just that it's really scared as a company. It's looking at the ways that companies like it die. And it's seeing that it's in the position, no one is going to come along and replace Facebook. But what they might do is they might slowly start unbundling it. Instagram may have been in a position to take Facebook's position as the dominant photo sharing website away from it. WhatsApp may have been in a position to take Facebook's position as a dominant messaging app away from it. So what it does is it buys in companies which might be in a position to disaggregate the services that Facebook provides, takes them under its wing, and then it doesn't really care whether that disaggregation happens. It's all part of the big friendly Facebook conglomerate.
I think you're quite right, Alex. I wouldn't say that Facebook's scared, though. I think Mark Zuckerberg is one of the most powerful people in technology on the planet now. He has a huge amount of money. He's got a huge amount of confidence. And yes, I think if they see a threat to their business, they can just afford to buy it. And WhatsApp was something like 20% of Facebook's market cap. And it doesn't really look like he thought too hard about it. He was absolutely clear that this is what they needed to do. Everyone was surprised at the amount, but nobody was surprised that was what they wanted to buy.
Oftentimes, when you see this kind of technology acquisition, you see the companies buying up the products and then it's an acqui-hire. They put the product on the shelf. But that's not the case, is it, Alex, for WhatsApp? WhatsApp seems to be announcing new things. Is it still going to retain its autonomy?
Yeah. I mean, WhatsApp is... This is why I use the word conglomerate. This seems to be the way Facebook is dealing with especially its larger profile acquisitions going forward. They keep an independent identity. They, by and large, also keep an independent revenue stream. So you're seeing Instagram's introducing its own advertising. WhatsApp is still charging $1 a year, which if you have 450 million users isn't bad. And yeah, WhatsApp is moving ahead with further features. They're launching voice calls and they are very, very explicit that they don't really want much Facebook integration in the app.
This is akin to Microsoft buying Skype. Mm. This is Facebook buying a voice calling service. They've never expressed any interest to do voice calling before. But given that they are arguably the central repository for people communicating rather than doing web-based services, which is what Google does, I think that's hugely significant.
We will hear more about the voice service that's being offered, that was announced at Mobile World Congress when we speak with Samuel Gibbs later on in the podcast. But you can read more on theguardian.com/technology about the purchase, and you can find other things that $19 billion could have bought at thingsthatarecheaperthanwhatsapp.tumblr.com. Hi. hot on the heels of Flappy Bird, another gaming craze broke out this week, and Alex Hearn, you managed to spot it. Congratulations. Tell me, what is this Twitch Plays Pokemon thing all about?
Twitch is a service that lets gamers stream games online to audiences, occasionally paying. It grew up around the esports movement, essentially. People playing competitive games like Team Fortress 2, Dota 2, or StarCraft 2, a lot of sequels, would get audiences who would watch them, occasionally playing seriously, just as frequently having a bit more of a fun time. But Twitch Plays Pokemon takes this idea of streaming a live game and slightly abuses it. Instead, what is running is a very, very old game, a copy of Pokemon Red from 1996, and it's not controlled by the person streaming it. Instead, it's controlled through the chat box on Twitch. If you type A into the box, around 20 seconds later, once the lag runs out, the command A will be input into the Game Boy. That's fine if you've got two or three people watching it. Last time I opened the stream, 150,000 people were watching and playing simultaneously. Essentially, you've got anarchy, but what's really interesting is that out of it, the game is still playable. They are still very, very slowly progressing through, catching Pokemon, defeating gym bosses, and actually doing quite well.
So what you're saying is this is a massively multiplayer online game in which everybody is controlling a single creature. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's almost a massively single player online game.
Yeah, I suppose it would be, wouldn't it? Except there are lots of people who are playing.
Yeah, it's I mean, there's a bunch of ways you can look at it. And on the one hand, it's an interesting experiment that is less broken than you'd think it might be. In another way, it's putting the sort of infinite number of monkeys theorem to test. If you actually have 150,000 people, all with their own ideas about where the character should go or what it should do, can you get order out of chaos? If there's 500,000 people who want, or if there's 80,000 people who want to go up and 70,000 people who want to go down, what happens in that situation?
What does happen in that situation? How does it kind of figure itself out?
Occasionally what happens is you have a relatively clear goal. The players are trying to head up to the next town, and absent a few griefers, people who just want to cause trouble, they're all broadly agreed that up is the direction they want to go. So what you have is the majority of the command's input being up. Occasionally there'll be a down or a left or a right, and then sometimes there'll be a random battle and they'll all start shouting A and clicking their way through. The problems come when there needs to be finer control. So occasionally in Pokemon, there's a few mazes that the player has to navigate. There's a couple of times when one misplaced command can be problematic. Initially, they just fought through them. There's one bit which is a ledge. You just have to walk 12 places to the right and then up, and that's it. That's all it takes. But if you press down at any point on that, you fall off and have to start again. It took them 7 hours to get through this. To walk 12 paces to the right. After that, the person running the stream changed it slightly so that players can also vote for democracy mode. In democracy mode, the command that is input the most times in a 10-second span then gets executed, so you can do that finer control. It's still not easy, and if you watch them playing through it that way, there's still a lot of very odd commands and a lot of people who can't quite agree where they want to go, but it lets them overcome some of these problems.
Keith, this sounds immensely frustrating. Why is it fun?
Well, I think actually what's fascinating about it, and maybe what is fun about it, is the fact that it's a kind of microcosm of the way that gamer communities tend to work online, which is that you will have a reasonably high percentage of people who are kind of highly engaged and really involved in the task and really want to do well with it. And then there's like a small percentage of, as Alex said, of griefers who want to try and ruin everything. And on first-person shooters, these people are usually called team killers, because in the olden days before you couldn't shoot other... because now you can't shoot other people on your team usually in games like Call of Duty, but in the olden days you could on things like Battlefield 1942. And it captures that kind of conflict between those people who just want to be anarchic all the time and the people that actually want to engage. And I think it's kind of... There's a weird kind of fascination with watching this this character slowly hobble through this world controlled by 150,000 different people, because there is this recognition that in fact, in so many ways, this represents what it's like playing games online as well. And you also get these, Alex, you get these kind of instant mythologies coming up, don't you, of things that happen in the game suddenly become kind of cultish actions.
Yeah, so like... way back near the beginning, about a week ago now, the mists of time, the players acquired the Helix Fossil, which is an item in Pokemon which can later on in the game be turned into a new Pokemon, an Omanyte. Until you use it to get that new Pokemon, it's entirely useless. It does absolutely nothing. But it found its way to the top of the item list, so that it was the very first thing on the list. Items are accessible in battle. What ended up happening is the pseudo-random clicks meant that they kept trying to use the Helix Fossil in battle again and again and again and again. And eventually, the way the players sort of rationalized this or turned it into a joke or made it anything other than mind-numbingly irritating is by, you know, creating this myth that they were calling to the Holy Helix Fossil for guidance, that when their player didn't know what to do, he checked the Helix Fossil and it gave him the strength to continue. And as the game went on, more and more things like this happened. So they would they picked an Eevee, which is a Pokemon that can evolve into either a water type or a fire type or a leaf type, I think so. I'm remembering way back. They picked an Eevee. They needed to evolve it into a water type so that they could surf and get to the next location. Instead, they evolved it into a fire type. They bought the wrong stone and then used it. And you could see in the chat, everyone's going, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And they still managed to end up doing it. This Pokemon was hopeless to them. They couldn't use it to progress any further. And so in the mythology, it became Flareon, the false prophet. Then they put Flareon in the PC where you store Pokemon. And they put a Drowsy, a Tapir-type Pokemon in front of it. And so Drowsy became the keeper of Flareon, entrusted with... And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And... frankly, right now, I've been following this for 4 days, and I don't quite understand how the mythology has reached where it is, and I was there for most of it.
And this is in the space of a few days. But I think that's the beautiful thing about it. It kind of shows that gamers are used to sort of narrativizing, get things within games themselves, because games usually have so many plot holes and gaps and mysteries in them. And this one experience has managed to, in the space of a week, kind of explore a whole history of the way gamers create narratives and create plots out of the chaos of online gaming.
PhDs unite. Go and find. There's going to be a future in this, I can imagine. And anybody who's interested, even if you don't have academic pretensions, can read up on Alex and Keith's coverage of Twitch Plays Pokemon at theguardian.com/technology. If there's one thing the WhatsApp price tag tells us, it's that mobile is a white-hot space for tech and digital. It's perhaps no surprise that this year's Mobile World Congress in Barcelona is a well-attended affair. And covering MWC for The Guardian is our very own Samuel Gibbs, and he joins me down the line now. Hey, Samuel, how are you?
Hey, good, thanks.
Are you run off your feet, Samuel? This is a big conference to be covering.
It certainly is. There are up to about 75,000 people here, every mobile company under the sun is all under one roof in one massive convention center. It's exciting.
Have you sort of become overwhelmed by the blinging and the tinging and all of the ginging?
The classic Nokia tune. I've definitely heard that a few times. It's all right, you know. As long as you stay away from the booths and their repetitive spiel that goes on almost a loop, you can maintain your sanity. It's just about manageable.
Well, let's get down to some of the news, because as we reported last week, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg was there to talk about the purchase of the mobile messaging service WhatsApp. What else did he say?
Yes, well, so he briefly mentioned WhatsApp, but what he really was here to talk about was internet.org, which, for those who don't know, is a coalition of Facebook with six or plus telco companies, including Ericsson, with a basic mission to connect the next 5 billion people to the internet, which is, you know, just a simple plan. He was discussing things like what he called the internet on-ramp. And really, that's just a term to get people tempted to buy into the internet. So he was saying that their plan is to, with telecommunications companies, internet service providers, provide basic services to text-based services, and in his case, Facebook and messaging, as you might imagine, for free. And then if people use those, they're more likely to see the benefit of the internet, and then they can upgrade to a paid service for, you know, streaming video or anything further beyond that. And the idea is that they're encouraging people to take up the internet when they not necessarily see a benefit to it, when they're on a limited income, where they have a small amount of disposable income, a small amount of income that could go on in an internet connection, but they spend it on other things because they just can't see the benefit.
Frankly, that's also something that Facebook has, I would argue, great experience at. You know, that you could say that Facebook brought a huge number of people online when it opened up and people started to want to connect with their friends and see pictures of other people's babies.
Yes, for sure. And it's definitely in Facebook's vested interest to get more people online. I mean, a social network is only as good as its users, and as a social network ceases to grow, things start to look a bit tricky. So Facebook's starting to reach saturation point in quite a lot of the developed world. So its next big user base is the developing world, and this is one of the reasons that Facebook's involved in this. But Mark Zuckerberg was keen to point out that Facebook was investing lots and lots of money in this, but was unlikely to see a return, definitely in the short term, possibly ever. It's more of a philanthropy kind of way of going about it.
Well, let's talk about some of the other things that have gone on, because frankly, I've heard the word Facebook too much in this podcast already. Samsung has been absolutely overwhelming, hasn't it, this year at MWC?
It's certainly been a bit of a Samsung bonanza. Not only have they released their latest flagship Android smartphone, the Galaxy S5, but they also released three smart wearables, the Gear 2, the Gear 2 Neo, which is effectively the Gear 2 but without a camera, and the smaller Gear Fit, which is an interesting device, kind of sitting in between the smartwatch and the fitness band space. It's got a curved OLED screen, which is one of the first released on the device, and they're all able to track your heartbeat, but this one's kind of like aimed at the fitness person more than the smartwatch wearing person. They're an interesting bunch. And Samsung's Galaxy S5, that too has a heart rate monitor in it. It's directly below the camera. You stick your finger on it and it measures your pulse. To me, it's kind of a weird thing to add, but it doesn't actually add any bulk and you can't see it. So I think it's one of those value adds that some people will use, some people will just totally ignore.
So Samuel, coming back to Barcelona, we also saw the launch of Sony's latest tablet. What is unique and different about this one?
To be honest, it's a beautiful piece of hardware. It really is.
You sound like it was love at first sight, Samuel.
More or less. It's only 6.4 millimeters thin. So if you can imagine that, it's probably thinner than most people's smartphones out there. And it's only 426 grams. So it's a full-size 10-inch tablet that really feels lightweight, and it feels like the future. We're finally getting to the point where tablets are really taking on the almost Star Trek feel of being able to throw around, and you know, and it's waterproof too. It's a real Android challenger to the Apple's iPad Air, which again is very thin and light. So it was really great to see. They've even managed to pack noise cancelling technology into it. So using a special headset, all the gubbins that make the active noise cancelling, which blocks out outside sounds, are all integrated into the tablet, so you don't have to have a thick battery pack attached to it. It's great. It's going to be interesting to see what it's like when we get it back in the testing lab.
And what about the price point for something like that? You said that it's an Android contender to the iPad's current throne.
Yes, so it's not going to be cheap. We're looking probably around the £400 to £500 mark. There are a couple of models, one including 4G LTE. So it's going to be competitively priced with the iPad Air, which is around £400.
And finally, there's been quite a lot of Nokia news as well, hasn't there? Because their relationship with Windows is obviously forthcoming. Watch this space. But then they went Android for this particular Congress, didn't they?
Yes, it's an interesting play. So what Nokia's done here is it has taken Android, but it's not Google's Android. It's effectively the open source software that underlies Android with a Microsoft skin over the top of it. So when you look at it, it doesn't look anything like traditional Android as you would on say, like the Nexus 5, for instance. It looks much more like Windows Phone. There are tiled interface, there are live tiles, and all sorts of things like that. And effectively what they're doing is they're using the Android platform to make phones at a more budget price point, effectively from about 109 euros at the top end down to 89 euros at the cheaper end. So for Nokia and even for Microsoft, this is a way to, it's a bit like Mark Zuckerberg's internet.org on-ramp. This is an introduction to people buying maybe their first smartphone, buying a cheaper Nokia device that introduces them to Microsoft through the Microsoft services they've integrated into the Android operating system. And then from there, the idea is to then leapfrog up to the Windows Phone, the Lumia brand, as Nokia calls it. It's an interesting play, and it's definitely ruffled some feathers.
Has it ruffled any Microsoft feathers?
Well, it's an interesting thing. It's not easy to tell. There are a lot of Microsoft services on it, and it looks like a Microsoft device. And so Microsoft has definitely had some play in this. Whether they keep it on after the acquisition of Nokia has completed later this year, I don't know. It may be Nokia's first and last Android family.
Samuel, you also managed to catch up with Nick D'Aloisio, the creator of new service Sumly, which he sold to Yahoo earlier this year. It was announced at CES. What was he doing in Barcelona?
So he was basically here to launch News Digest, the app based on Sumly, Yahoo News Digest in the UK. So it was a UK edition, which isn't quite the same as the US edition. The app is the same, but the place where it sources its news is different, and it's got a different editorial team behind it. I mean, the app essentially uses both machine and human curation to summarize the most important news of the day in kind of two daily bands, well, one in the morning and one in the evening. And it kind of, it's your daily briefing. That's what it basically is. So when I met up with Nick D'Aloisio, I asked him what kind of reaction did he have to the launch of News Digest in the UK?
Yeah, so it went up this morning. It's almost 1 p.m. now. So the app's actually ranked already number 9 on the App Store and for news, which is great news. And hopefully throughout the coming days, continue to get downloads. It'll be really interesting to see if the retention in the product in the UK is the same as in the US, because we launched about 6 weeks ago now in the US App Store, and so it's very interesting to see. We've had strong retention, a lot of users coming back every day.
So what took the time from the US launch at CES to the UK launch now? Why did it take so long?
I mean, well, two things. First off, Yahoo has a bit of a philosophy around staggered launching anyway, because it's a US company. It's kind of a policy of recursion and first launch in one market, make sure it's successful, and if it is, expand quickly. So in the case of this product, we saw very good indicative figures to demonstrate that it would be very well taken in other countries and markets. So that's what we've done here. Also, we actually have had to get kind of a, in the UK, an editorial team here to help support the digest, because it's a hybrid of algorithm and editorial. And also we've synthesized and are using all of UK content sources. So it's a different actual content pool in the US, which is also very good.
So is The Guardian included in it?
I'm not sure. I don't think it is. We're using licensed content that Yahoo has deals with pre-existing. So if we ever deal, it'll be there.
Fair enough. So where's next for the News Digest app? I mean, UK, US, where next?
Yeah, so far UK and US, for me it's kind of markets, so beyond that, English speaking and other languages, platforms, so it's iOS only at the moment, but clearly there's a lot of opportunity both on small screen and also tablet. And then finally, I think expanding these atoms, so the product, each story is kind of comprised of these, what we're calling atoms or units of information, and there's summaries, images, videos, Wikipedia, tweets coming through maps, we have these kind of visual dimensions, and so we want as many of these as possible, and that's kind of going to be an ongoing effort of the team.
So when's the Android app coming?
We might not even be working on one, but we're aware of other platforms, so as soon as possible, we'll be kind of looking to launch things.
Good, because some of us are Android users. So since the acquisition, have you moved? I mean, you were based in Wimbledon. Have you moved to the States?
No, I still live in Wimbledon. I go to the Yahoo office in Shaftesbury Avenue, and then I kind of travel probably once a month or so to America, to San Francisco office there, where my team is. So it's been kind of a bit back and forthing. But as with Summer, you know, we had a very virtual team there as well. So I find that the time zone difference isn't actually that bad, and we're able to still be very productive.
So lots of late nights and early mornings?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, unfortunately early mornings, but a lot of late nights with the time zone 8 hours behind. And I'm kind of still actually completing my A-level exams this summer. So still doing a lot of work for school as well. So it's kind of been juggling the two. It's been quite interesting.
You're at King's, right? Yeah. And how do you like King's? It's the top of my road. I live on Edge Hill, so...
Should we see us coming out of school? I mean, I love King's. It's a good school. They've been very supportive over the last few years with Sumley and everything else. And so it's kind of really fun now, kind of finishing up, doing my A-levels and then kind of moving on.
So how does News Digest fit in with kind of like the digital magazine front of Yahoo? I mean, Yahoo seems to be verging towards becoming the kind of a tech media company away from just a tech company. So what's next for your vision of the app and the integration with the magazines?
Yeah, so the magazines is an effort primarily on the web experience. Yahoo News Digest, because within the mobile and emerging products, is focused on the native experience. And I think there's definitely synergies to be had with the notion of the atoms. So we're really a strong believer in this idea of, you know, content traditionally, if it's lots of text, might not necessarily be optimized for phone, both mobile, web, and native experiences. And so by using Yahoo News Digest as an experimental platform, we're trying to see if this notion of atoms works. And if it does, clearly there's a lot of properties within Yahoo that could greatly benefit from that and integrating that technology. And we work very closely with the digital magazines team, with the web team, with the homepage team, with the, you know, the other applications that Yahoo have. So there's a lot of opportunities for integration.
So we've seen Facebook take a much more mobile-focused approach. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg's here, and we've just heard from the WhatsApp founder. What do you think of Facebook Paper?
It's an interesting product. You know, I know the guy who, Chris Cox, that team, they're really good, they're really talented, and I think as a Facebook kind of reader or application, it's very interesting. I think it's doing a different thing to what we're doing with News Digest and indeed the other news apps. That's why it's in the social networking category. But I think what I'm, you know, I at the end of the day, I'm a technologist. I'm really excited about applications and user experiences, and so kind of evaluating that product just from a user experience standpoint and the design, I think they've done very well.
Yahoo paid about £18 million, more or less, for Sumley, and we've recently been... some people shocked by the purchase of WhatsApp by Facebook for $19 billion US dollars. Were you shocked by the valuation?
I wouldn't use the word shocked. I think, again, working in the mobile app ecosystem, it's very clear to see that some applications do just get an uptake of users that is just phenomenal and of another scale, an exponential scale. And that's really valuable for kind of large companies to have that scale and reach in markets like third world markets that traditionally the main US companies might not have. And so it's an unprecedented price. I think it's very interesting for the ecosystem and to see where that leads.
Do you think you should have held out for a bit more cash?
No. I'm very happy with what happened with Sumley and the work that we're doing now with News Digest. I'm very proud to kind of have launched it now in the UK, almost a year on since the acquisition to the month. And so I'm enjoying my experience here.
So how big is your team behind the app now?
I mean, we don't really go into specifics, but it's quite interdisciplinary because we have editors and people from that side of the world. We have designers, people in labs working the algorithm, mobile engineers. And so the team's kind of scattered between London and Sunnyvale or in America. But I've really enjoyed kind of working and collaborating because I think although Yahoo is a big company, it's a traditional US internet company, since Marissa Meyer, the culture within has felt very much like a startup. And so I've been able to leverage that freedom and almost autonomy to kind of help build this product. And we've been collaborating a lot with other teams within the mobile product because Yahoo's had some very successful apps recently, like the weather app. And so it's really nice to be able to learn from what they've done and share design ideas and collaborate.
So is there a true integration between each of the teams?
I think just naturally, the way the teams are structured, you know, we're all on one floor, we all work together. The mobile team's continuing to grow. And so I've just been very, I guess, I was surprised because I didn't know what to expect coming into the company. I was surprised to see the kind of the amount of innovation that's happening within Yahoo and a lot of kind of experimental ideas and taking risks and seeing what works, which is great to see.
And so have you any other ideas that you've got in the pipeline? I mean, is Yahoo supportive of further ideas beyond News Digest, or are you kind of anchored to one at the moment?
I feel very passionate because News Digest is so analogous to Summly and what we were doing there to kind of keep continuing on it. It has been the thing I've been primarily working on for the past 10 months. But having said that, because there's a lot of products within the mobile team, I try and help or get involved where I can. So it's not like I'm strictly working on just a one product, but this has definitely been very something close to my heart.
That was our own Samuel Gibbs in Barcelona at Mobile World Congress, speaking with Summly's Nick Melosio. You can read more of our MWC coverage at theguardian.com/technology. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Three cheers to the in-studio team and to Samuel, working hard, treading the boards in Barcelona. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps and is presented by me, Alex Kratosky. We are back every Wednesday, so we'll see you next week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.